Tower.
Hi, Matt. How are you today?
I'm good. I'm hoping that the generous application of sticky crazy glue on my camera will solve some zoom problems I've had.
So it won't zoom into your nose without any warning at all.
Right, exactly. Hopefully it'll stick, you know. It seems like a good product.
All right, so today we're going to start out with Valerie Plame, I think, right? And
yes.
It seems to me the story right now is the aftermath, if any, of her testimony before the House. And I did a story today for National Review Online showing that that Senator Christopher Bond, who is now the vice chairman, the number two guy, the Republican guy on the Senate Intelligence Committee, seems to be kind of comparing the story that Valerie Plame Wilson told to the Senate committee when they were doing their investigation, which came out in the summer of 2004, comparing that with what she told the House Committee on Government Oversight and Reform on Friday.
Right. So now your point is that there's an inconsistency, according to Senator Bond,
well,
and you...
You know, I'm not sure...
Between what she said yesterday... this refers to what she said about her role in Joe Wilson.
That's right.
Being sent over to Niger.
The critical matter here, for the moment, is how did the CIA come to pick Joe Wilson for this mission to Niger? And if you followed the Libby trial, you saw that when Joe Wilson started kind of taking shots at the administration, first anonymously. Uh-huh. And then by name in an op-ed in the New York Times in July 6 of 2003. The question in the vice president's office was, who is this guy, and did we send this guy? And there's this phone call with Libby, Louis Libby, and a top official of the CIA named Robert Grenier, in which Libby had demanded to know, did we send this guy? Which is kind of a classic question in a big organization. You see something happen, you think, did we do this? And Grenier explains to him that, we did send this guy. And then the question was, well, how did we choose this Joe Wilson, who's now kicking us in the shins? And they said, well, his wife works here. So there was this question, and she suggested it. I mean, that's what Grenier testified. And so there was this question of how it happened. And when she talked to the House on Friday, she said that there was this day, it was in February 2002, and she said, a young junior officer who worked for me came to me very concerned, very upset. She just received a call on her desk from someone, I don't know who, in the office of the vice president, asking about this report of this alleged sale of yellowcake uranium from Niger. Now, then she says, so this young junior officer is telling Valerie Plame Wilson what has happened. And she says, as she was telling me what had happened, someone passed by, another officer heard this. He knew that Joe had already, my husband, had already gone on some CIA missions previously to deal with other nuclear matters, and he suggested, well, why don't we send Joe? And so that was the genesis of the story. All I reported today was that the Senate Intelligence Committee had interviewed her, and they were very interested in what role, if any, she played in her husband's trip to Niger, because that was a very hot issue at the time.
Right.
And she never told him this story. She didn't tell him about the young junior officer and the call from the vice president's office
and the
guy who's passing by and says, hey, why don't we send Joe?
But I guess here's my question, because I'm not really obsessed.
You're not a Plameologist.
I had the occasion to meet Joe Wilson on a park bench in Cambridge, Massachusetts, in the summer of 2004, and he struck me as a bit off.
Mm-hmm.
Starting at that point,
could you elaborate on that? I'm just curious. I don't. What was your impression?
I don't want to be accused of any perjuries here. It was years ago, but. I introduced myself because, he was a hot sort of commodity at that time. He said that, expressed some familiarity with my blog, and we started talking. I mean, we talked some about his experience. And then he very quickly got into sort of speculating about, you know, sort of machinations inside the Bush administration, yeah. not claiming to have detailed insider knowledge right. about this stuff, but just the kind of, you know, spitballing mm-hmm. that people do. But in a... He had a sort of, I would say, just conspiracy theorists mm-hmm. sort of attitude yeah. as to, you know, what was happening inside policy circles. You know, in a way that indicated to me that it was going to be hard to sort out, mm-hmm. even when he was just talking about himself, right. what were, you know, things he actually knew from firsthand experience, and what was sort of, you know, his semi-informed speculation right. about right. what was happening. And, you know, then at the same time, you know, I guess this is coming back to my question for you, is I've never entirely understood what the point mm-hmm. of some of these questions about the details yeah. of his story and her story exactly are. I mean, I understand that you know, the two of them, and especially Joe, sort of went after the Bush administration really hard so that Republican partisans are sort of, you know, eager to find, you know, disparaging things they can say about them. Yeah. But, you know, at this point in time, in 2007, I mean, why do I really care what role Valerie Wilson
well,
had
I think,
getting her husband?
No, that, look, that's a perfectly good question, and there's no doubt that the plainologists get very, very deep in the weeds. The only reason I think I would say is that, one, we've just had this big trial.
Sure.
And the vice president's former chief of staff is a pretty big deal, was convicted of perjury and obstruction. And then I think it's clear that Democrats on the Hill see some political utility from this because they called this hearing. And, you know, the alleged or ostensible purpose of the hearing was to examine White House policies for protecting the identities of intelligence assets. Didn't really touch on that very much. But so, I mean, it's look, I think that this whole thing is on the downslope. I mean, I think we're on the backside of this scandal, but, you know, since it has become kind of a truth commission. I mean, the Pat Fitzgerald investigation was kind of a truth commission, and now, believe me, Mrs. Wilson's words are going to be scrutinized very carefully as she goes out in public. And then the last act of this, at least I hope the last act, will be their lawsuit against several members of the Bush administration. So, you know, why should we care about it? You don't really have to care about it. It's not absolutely critical. But it is it's an interesting, you know, subset of this much bigger fight, the war over the war. So, it's useful for that. But I think, right now, the question is, the real question, and this is something you probably should be interested in, is whether Democrats see any further utility in this, whether they would see any use in, say, calling people who testified before Fitzgerald's grand jury, calling them up to the Hill and actually sort of making them replay their testimony in public and under oath, and conducting kind of a parallel investigation to the Fitzgerald investigation. My belief is that they probably will come to believe that that would be beating a dead horse, and there are lots of other things that they can used to whack at the Bush administration other than that.
Right. I mean, Henry Waxman's docket is pretty long
it is.
At this point.
It is.
You know, and I think may decide he has bigger fish
yeah.
to fry,
yeah.
Which may, I guess, segue us into our
exactly.
Our next topic.
Because the next fish that really is quite current and quite hot and is this U.S. attorneys thing. And you had a question about, specifically about Alberto Gonzalez.
Yeah, I mean, because, you know, I mean, one interesting thing about this is that I think, you know, conservative sort of defense of the Bush administration has been less than 100% lockstep, which, you
sure.
know, tends to indicate. I'm not a big
Well, wait, what
scandal.
Would that indicate? I mean, I think it indicates some independence of mind, I think.
Oh, right, no, but, you know, I mean, I'm not a huge scandal person mm-hmm. myself, you know, but so it's the ones when I see, you know, not just sort of Josh Marshall making the allegations,
right.
but, you know, some of your colleagues on the corner indicating that there may be a real problem
mm-hmm.
here, that makes me think mm-hmm. there may be a real problem here. But the other interesting thing is that even among people who, conservatives who I've seen have tended to defend the propriety of what the administration did, there's been just a sort of lot of real kind of lack of enthusiasm right. for defending the person of Alberto Gonzalez yeah. and feeling sort of annoyed that they need to, you know, go out on right. on his behalf and maybe want to deny yeah. liberals a scalp, but that, you know, like Rich Lowry wrote some extremely disparaging mm-hmm. things about him that were actually unrelated mm-hmm. to this scandal, right. but just saying, you know, he was unqualified for the job. Yeah. Nobody except George W. Bush thought he should be attorney general. Mm-hmm. And I just don't recall having... there was an actual fight over his confirmation.
Yeah. Well,
I don't recall having heard this kind of right. sentiment before.
Well, I can reveal all to you. And right. the issue that conservatives and Republicans are both have with Gonzalez is the Supreme Court. You cannot think about Gonzalez without thinking about the Supreme Court. And basically, conservatives have been terrified for a long time that Bush, who's very loyal to people who are very loyal to him, mm-hmm. would appoint Gonzalez to the Supreme Court, would nominate him to the Supreme Court. And this was something that has, you know, it's just been dreaded by conservatives who are really, really interested in court appointments. Now, the reason is...
because he's secretly pro-choice.
Well, they view him as a squish. I think the best way to describe him is they view him as a squish, somebody who doesn't have firm beliefs on some of the key issues that come before the court, issues like affirmative action, perhaps on choice, perhaps on some other things. But they view him as a guy without a sort of fixed legal North Star. And they also think that there are so many conservative superstars in the legal world, and certainly John Roberts and Sam Alito were two of those before they were nominated, that to essentially waste a nomination on Gonzalez would be a terrible thing. And that's, of course, part of the anger that you saw over the Harriet Myers nomination, which
right.
they unanimously viewed as just a terrible, terrible choice.
Right.
So,
and she's also involved in this.
Yeah, so,
the attorneys,
so
right.
you'll notice that the subtext and sometimes the actual declared text of this Gonzalez thing is that, well, at least he's not going to be nominated to the Supreme Court now. I think probably nobody thinks that would happen. So you can't understand the feelings about Gonzalez without that. Now, as far as him being attorney general, that is the president's choice, serves at the pleasure of the president. It's not nearly, in the view of a lot of conservatives, as important as a Supreme Court justice. So, no, there wasn't a lot of, or any outrage that I'm aware of, when he was nominated to be Attorney General, because they weren't worried that much about it. And I think they also felt that John Ashcroft had done a lot of the heavy lifting in the Attorney General's office after September 11th. So, you know, that is the deal with Alberto Gonzalez. He has never been a favorite of conservatives, and he's never going to be, and their views of him were always colored by this fear that he'd be nominated to the court.
You know, I mean, I think along these lines, though, that, you know, one thing you observe and that, you know, does come up in the course of this controversy is that, unlike most cabinet agencies, I think it actually is desirable to have an attorney general with some degree of independence from the president.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, I wrote back either when Gonzalez, I guess when Gonzalez was nominated, I wrote that, you know, even the liberals had really disliked John Ashcroft
right.
because of his very conservative views, that we were probably going to miss him in office, that it was good and that we were going to like it better when the attorney general was someone with an independent political identity
mm-hmm.
and an independent mm-hmm. political constituency
and
a real kind of history mm-hmm. rather than, I mean, Gonzalez, I don't think it's too harsh to say he's kind of a second-rate nobody who, you know, happens to be buddies with the president of the United
mm-hmm.
States. And you know, I mean, that's fine in, like, a secretary of commerce because, you know, nobody knows what the Commerce
right.
Department does. But these people, you know, as you see, I mean, they're
yeah.
political appointees, but they're not supposed to be part of the president's political machine.
Right. Well, I think, you know, I think in theory or in a perfect world, what you're saying is correct. But
mm-hmm.
it just hasn't worked out the way. First of all, it hasn't worked out that way because, I mean, a lot of our attorney generals were not very distinguished. I mean, I certainly don't think Janet Reno was very distinguished as an attorney general. Now, she was not a crony.
No, she wasn't distinguished.
No, but she was.
But she also wasn't like
she
a,
wasn't
like
a crony of the Clintons, and I think...
A crony of the Clintons. And she was his, third choice, right?
Yeah, right. Actually, his other choices weren't cronies either. The interesting thing about it, but you have to understand, presidents have always, for obvious reasons, wanted to keep pretty close control of what's going on at the Justice Department. That's why John F. Kennedy appointed his brother to be the Attorney General. And that's why the Clintons put Webb Hubble in a very, very high position in the Justice Department. And that's part of why Alberto Gonzalez is the Attorney General. I mean, this is, it's maybe not in the perfect world, but, the president is head of the executive branch, and this is a very sensitive place in the executive branch. It can make a lot of trouble for a lot of people. So it's not at all unusual for the president to want to keep close tabs on it.
Right. Well, but then, I mean, getting to the specifics of the attorneys, mm-hmm. It really is unusual to see this kind of, specific, politicization of those offices. I mean, now, as the administration's been pointing out, I mean, it is true that when Bill Clinton came in and all of the U.S. attorneys had been appointed by his Republican predecessors, he got rid of them all and brought in a whole new sort of clean slate. But that was still done, it was done in consultation with their home state senators, and it was it was like a one-time thing. He didn't then micromanage their performance in office the way that's being suggested.
The big thing here is the way the administration has handled it. Each new president is going to, especially a president when the parties change, is going to do, he's going to replace all the U.S. attorneys. The difference with Clinton, of course, is he did it in one fell swoop, which was unusual. Usually it's taken about a year for the turnover. But the fact is, and the reason Clinton did this, I've been talking to people about it just today, as a matter of fact. I mean, Clinton was very anxious to make his mark on the executive branch as quickly as possible because it had been under Republican control for 12 years. And Republicans were deeply entrenched in the executive branch, and Clinton wanted to, rip them out root and branch as he could, because he now controlled political appointments. So he did the U.S. attorneys very fast, where other presidents, including Bush, had done them more slowly. And there's also, by the way, been consideration when a president is reelected. The U.S. attorney is appointed originally to a 4-year term, but it appears that nobody really pays attention to that. I talked to one today who was appointed by Clinton, and he said, well, I got appointed to a 4-year term in 93, and then the phone really didn't ring until 2001. And it was somebody saying leave. He said there had been a lot of talk about the possible replacement of everybody, having everybody resign in 97, right when the president got reelected. Didn't happen. Just as there was talk about it with Bush. It seems to me the questions with Bush are, one, there's no doubt that they handled the getting rid of these 8 U.S. attorneys in a really ham-handed way, and they got a lot of people mad at them. The scent of impropriety, of course, is if they tried to do it to interfere with ongoing investigations, and we don't know anything about that. My feeling is that they didn't. And certainly it didn't have the effect of doing that. It looked terrible. And then the third element of it is that after they had fired these people, then they kind of smeared them and said they were being dumped because of their poor performance.
Right, because they were incompetent.
Yeah, so they handled it in a really bad way, and then they didn't tell the truth about it. So,
And then why would Gonzalez, this is a little petty, but who... Why would you use the specific phrase "mistakes were made"? Don't they realize that?
Yeah,
that
right. Because you have the biggest can ear in politics, I think.
Yeah, I don't know. I saw that headline: Gonzalez colon mistakes were made. I thought it was like a joke.
It is like a joke,
like a sarcastic liberal take on what he had said. But I mean, that's literally what he said, which is inspired comment.
It was a terrible look. That was in political terms. That was a terrible performance. People I know I've talked to about this do not expect him to survive this, and some other people at the Justice Department perhaps may go as well. My feeling is that this is not going to uncover any desire to or any attempt to stifle investigations, but it is going to show, an administration or White House that was, messing in things that it probably didn't need to be messing in, had the authority to, but did not need to be doing, and then handling it in a terrible way, and then not being upfront about the way they mishandled it. So, they're going to pay a political price now.
Right.
Now,
well,
is that what?
Not idea. So you wanted to talk about the war?
Oh, I did. I wanted to talk about these demonstrations because I've been to a bunch of these anti-war demonstrations. I did not actually go to the one in Washington on Saturday, but I've been to a number of them, and a lot of them are sponsored by, or at least organized by, this group, International Answer. And I wanted to read a little bit from David Kirkpatrick's story in the New York Times from Sunday. Sure. And it said, Saturday's march was organized by the Answer Coalition, named for Act Now to Stop War and End Racism, an organization that was initially associated with the Workers' World Party and now affiliated with a breakaway faction of that party called the Party for Socialism and Liberation. Judging by the speeches and placards, the marchers on Saturday set their sights on sweeping goals, including not only ending the war, but also impeaching President Bush and ending the Israeli occupation of Palestine. Many carried Answer Coalition signs bearing the image of the Latin American revolutionary Che Guevara. And yes. you go to these events, and they're just filled with all of these, you know, kind of crazy causes, and the people who organize them are actual communists. It's like a Jurassic Park experience. I mean, here they are, actual communists roaming the earth. And you thought they just weren't around anymore. And right. The question is, why can't the anti-war movement do better than this? Are these the only guys who can, like, rent sound systems and get the stage up, or what?
Well, you should distinguish between a couple of things here, right? I mean, there's a much more mainstream group in the sense of not being communists called United for Peace and Justice.
Absolutely, I understand.
Who organizes these protests. There's nothing they or I or anyone else can do to stop International Answer from organizing protests of its
own. Well, but they co-organized these things in the past. And as a matter of fact, I believe last one I went to, and I'm not saying that United for Peace and Justice really wants to be hand-in-hand with International Answer, but they end up doing it. So I'm just wondering why the anti-war movement even associates with these people who are, I mean, they're bad guys.
Yes, no, I mean this is not a good outfit. You know, I mean, one thing I would say is that, you know, obviously to some extent, I think, you know, conservatives make hay out of the presence of groups like International Answer for sort of cynical reasons. But then at another level, conservatives normally do not have any personal experience with trying to organize mass demonstrations. Mm-hmm. And you'll see if you do it, that it's actually, it becomes extremely difficult to sort of exclude people like this. When I was in college, you know, before these wars ever started, I was involved with planning some demonstrations that were around, you know, labor issues on campus, mm-hmm. having to do with the treatment of the janitors, the people who worked in the dining halls. Mm-hmm. And we were, you know, overwhelmingly not Trotskyites. But there was this sort of somewhat cult-esque...
That was your slogan, right? Overwhelmingly not Trotskyites, right?
No, exactly. But, you know, so there was this group which was based around there in Cambridge, Massachusetts, that had some members on campus, you know, actually, you know, among students who would join the group. But then other people would just hang around. And, you know, they would know whenever we were planning a demonstration, and they would show up with their people and with their signs and sort of get in the crowd. Mm-hmm. And it gets hard to know how you can exclude them. You know, I was always on sort of the far right faction of the campus left, and, you know, always took the attitude that, like, we should try and do something to get rid of these people, mm-hmm. because they would like come with signs about North Korea's right to nuclear weapons and, you know, crazy stuff that you don't really want to be associated with. But other people would take the view that they didn't want to start a process, mm-hmm. of sort of internal purging.
Right, right.
Of the organization, or to establish the precedent that the umbrella group, mm-hmm. accepts responsibility for any sentiment, mm-hmm. that someone may voice there. Right. So that, for example, you know, United for Peace and Justice includes in its coalition the American Friends Service Committee, mm-hmm. which, you know, nobody thinks is pernicious in the way, right. International Answer is, because, you know, Quakers are respectable people.
Right, right.
But at the same time, they are passive. And so now,
you would expect pacifists in an anti-war demonstration. I don't think anybody has a problem with that.
No, I mean, exactly. But so you get this dilemma, though, because people who organize an anti-war rally, or people who attend it, right, I don't want to accept the view that just because I'm against the Iraq War, that means secretly we're all pacifists. Mm-hmm. But then you say, well, wait, if you're not pacifists, how come the American Friends Service Committee is there? Right. And then I say, well, look, they're just here because they showed up. They want to participate. They're pacifists. They're against the war. But then you say, well, look, you know, like you kicked out International Answer because you didn't agree with their views. If you guys aren't pacifists, why don't you purge the pacifists? And, like, then we're sort of fucked. Next thing you know, there's nobody at your rally.
Well, you know, I think you're making one, I guess, mistake between making slight gradations between groups and then a group that's kind of beyond the pale. I mean, it's just International Answer is almost amusing, and they certainly are sort of fish in a barrel for conservatives, because you go to one of these rallies and it just has tons and tons of people in with all sorts of wacky causes.
Right.
And it does, in my view, diminish the anti-war movement. And I think one of the big interesting things about domestic reaction to this war is mm-hmm. that we haven't seen a really big anti-war movement, and we haven't seen, you know, a lot of these big demonstrations that don't have the sort of International Answer taint to them. I mean, the more anti-war demonstrations include what you might just call regular people who've never been to a demonstration before, you know, the more it seems to me to be politically, you know, valid. And not the usual suspects, because if you go to many demonstrations, you see a lot of the usual suspects. So it's one of the interesting things to me about domestic reaction to this war is that we are now beginning year five. And
sure.
we have not seen at least the sort of Vietnam style anti-war mm-hmm. movement.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, I think this gets to the flip side of what we were talking about before, which is that, you know, when the anti-war movement started, the war itself was quite popular. And then
it started before the war. I went to the anti-war demonstrations
right.
before the war started.
Right, right. And, you know, and at that point, the war was popular. And so the only people who were demonstrating, really, it was, well, no, I don't want to say the only people, because that would be a smear on them. But, you know, when there was relatively little anti-war sentiment, far left people were a pretty big proportion.
It was, yes.
Of people who were against the war.
Right.
And so, you know, it started that way. And then just over the years, I think with pretty good reason, an awful lot of people, myself included, have just become disillusioned with the mm-hmm. concept of protest politics, mm-hmm. in part because it seems like any time you try and organize a demonstration, mm-hmm. you are immediately hit with headaches about, you know, what you're going to do with the crazy people, and, you know, how
yes.
do you impose any kind of message discipline.
Right. Right.
And every time I've shown up at anti-war rallies, you know, I find myself doing a lot of head scratching mm-hmm. around some of these weird signs, and, you know, mm-hmm. do we really need the thing about how Dick Cheney's like a vampire, mm-hmm. and, you know, what is this accomplishing? But so then, you know, more mainstream-minded people tend to stay away. They're
but, you know, public demonstrations,
their congressmen, or, you know, doing God knows what.
But public demonstrations, I mean, show, you know, large shows of public concern did play a role in bringing the Vietnam War to a close.
Well, you know, I mean, my understanding is that there's some dispute about this, and that, you know, I mean, one issue the anti-war movement developed was that the anti-war movement itself began to frighten a lot of people
mm-hmm.
who, you know, people who had become disillusioned with the war. And I think a lot of people, myself included, you know, are inclined to believe that it's not an effective way to oppose the war, to sort of suggest, as was suggested by the anti-war movement in the early 70s, that opposition to the continuance of the war is sort of a piece with threats of social disorder and, mm-hmm. and that kind of thing. And that, mm-hmm. you know, we would much rather do things like, you know, people tried to get Democratic congressmen elected in 2006 on who were promising various kinds of plans to withdraw troops from Iraq.
Right.
And, you know, there was a reasonable amount of success in electing such candidates. You know, what kind of practical impact that's going to have. Obviously, well, that's our next topic and maybe can be segued into. But, you know, I think it's a good thing that people, because you're not immediately adjacent to the civil rights movement, mm-hmm. which was a period when sort of demonstrations and civil disobedience were really an important and useful political tactic, that now people have decided that, you know, you organize against the war the way you do anything else, which is mm-hmm. through conventional politics.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we get to the conventional politics, which is what's going on Capitol Hill, and very specifically what's going on among Democrats on Capitol Hill. I think it is interesting to the degree to which this story has become a Democratic story, because early on it seemed to be there was a lot of press emphasis on how many Republicans would be peeled off, how many Republicans would join them, but the story for weeks now has been Democratic disunity and difficulty in finding an actual strategy on the war. And the latest thing is this House Appropriations Committee handling the president's $100 billion request for supplemental funding for the troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. And the interesting thing about it is they've approved this money, but in a couple of ways. They've added all sorts of other stuff in a kind of a classic pork barrel style, $25 million for the spinach industry,
yes.
which was said to be in hopes of helping this man, Sam Farr, the Democrat from California, who's from that area. He's the guy who famously said that, people laugh at spinach, but if we ate more of it, we would be a stronger nation. And who's to deny that?
So this is basically, there's a lot of pork for sort of Democrats who represent more conservative districts.
Right, so the question is, what does that mean? Does that mean that the Democrats are having to sort of buy the support of some of their more conservative members to go along with a move to put the brakes on the war?
I mean, I think the short answer is yes. Mm-hmm. The longer answer is that the Democrats' dilemma is that they were elected with a mandate to do something that they're not constitutionally empowered to do,
right?
Which was to persuade the president
to
begin some kind of prudent process of withdrawing troops from Iraq.
Right.
But the Congress can't, in practice, unless maybe if you had two-thirds supermajorities and could just pass things over presidential vetoes, mm-hmm. Really could try and sort of, govern that way. But in practice, the congressional power over sort of active military deployments is extremely crude.
Can I interrupt here one time? Because I have been thinking about that, and everyone has been talking about the power of the purse, but you do go to the Constitution, and it's Article 1, Section 8 that says this, and it gives Congress the power to declare war, which we all know, to provide for the common defense, which we all know, to raise and support armies, to provide and maintain a navy, and to make rules for the government and regulation of the land and naval forces. I think it's clear that the founders intended as far as the military is concerned, the founders intended Congress to have more of a role than just writing the checks. And it seems to me that what we might find out here in the sort of headbanging that's going to be going on between the executive and the legislative over this is what kind of controlled Congress has beyond just writing those checks.
Right. Well, but I mean, of course, it's you can talk about the founders' intentions, right? But I mean, the founders wrote this document in a time when there was, no teleconferencing, no email, no fax machines, right? So, I mean, in practice, a local commander, right, like when Andrew Jackson was dispatched to fight the Battle of New Orleans, he was on his own. Like, the war had, in fact, ended by the time the battle was fought, but, nobody told him. So that, in those times, I think, Congress was granted sort of crude but real power over mm-hmm. these kind of situations, and was, expected to be able to exercise them. Mm-hmm. But that's because, the president's only powers were crude. The central government could only issue sort of vague, big-picture directives to other mm-hmm. people, try and go this way, or the war's over, stop fighting, that kind of thing. Nowadays, we expect, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, the head of Central Command in Tampa, the Secretary of Defense, the President of the United States, to be able to, day to day, be talking to his commanders on the ground, making plans, so on and so forth. Congress, being a collective entity, just can't insert itself into that kind of chain of command in a very nuanced way. All they can do is some kind of, you know, very hard cap, like, say, no more money for any troops in Iraq after, you know, June 2000, whatever, you know, which creates a lot of kind of weird standoffs, you know, where a president who really doesn't want to do that then tries to find loopholes, so on and so forth. It gets portrayed. Of course, the intention of a measure like that isn't for the troops to be in Iraq and then one day they run out of money. The intention would be for the president to have it be the case that there weren't troops in Iraq there anymore. But, you know, it can get portrayed politically all kinds of ways. It creates a lot of problems. And I think it means that, you know, unless you start seeing mass Republican defections away from the war, the Democrats aren't going to get very much done on this topic.
I think you're right. And I think that, first of all, we have these kind of tentative reports of progress as far as the surge is concerned, and in each one of those reports that we get makes it harder for the Democrats to attract any Republican support at all. The other thing is this Blue Dog group that, you know, after the election was given great credit for, you know, being the margin of victory for Democrats. I mean, they, you know, they're just not going to go along with this John Murtha stuff. I think Murtha made a terrible mistake when he spoke to the group. I've just forgotten the number. It was movecongress.org, I think. I believe it was associated with the group Win Without War, another one of these anti-war groups that's in the sort of mainstream anti-war group, I guess.
I mean, cause their head is like a former congressman.
Yeah, Tom Andrews is the is the guy who I believe was on Meet the Press on Sunday. He's been around quite a bit. And he interviewed Murtha, and I think Murtha made a terrible mistake in making it clear that he, Murtha, was putting forward these readiness standards and these rest period of rest standards as a way to kill the surge. We're going to kill the surge. We're going to make it absolutely impossible for them to do it. So I think that they are still smarting from that and are trying to figure out the next thing to do. And then you have Bush, you know, just giving this new speech about how this, you know, the surge is going to take months. It's not days. It's not weeks. And as long as there is some appearance of progress, measured basically in the return of some civil order, not actually in the number of Americans killed, which may go up, then I think it becomes very, very difficult for Democrats to do this. And they're, at the same time, they have these Blue Dogs to contend with. They do have the Out of Iraq Now coalition. And they've got a lot of angry people on the left. And I, you know, I don't know exactly what they can do. I'm sure you watched the video of David Obey in the hallway of the House Office Building with the anti-war people, and I mean his frustration was incredible.
Sure. Well, you know, I mean, especially the more liberal members like Obey are very frustrated with, you know, the sort of conflicting pressures on them.
He was frustrated with the left.
What?
He was frustrated with the left.
Well, he was frustrated with the left. But, I mean, the reason, like, you know, because his office tried to, you know, apologize to McNight for that. I mean, the reason he would lash out like that is that he's frustrated in general. And, yes, in particular, you know, a guy like Obey, who really is a liberal, is upset at the way people on the left are sort of, you know, impugning the good faith and, you know, his commitment to sort of their issues. You know, on the subject of the surge, I just want to say I would recommend an article Justin Logan wrote that was about this, where he noted, among other things, that there's always been, every year, a sort of seasonal dip in violence in Iraq around now, which may account for the, you know, appearance of progress in part. Obviously, we're going to have to wait and see.
Yeah,
because I think if we both agree, you know, one way or another, Bush is going to get to implement his surge plan.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I think the other thing, factor that has to be mentioned here is the fact that, you know, we've got this, you know, Republican primary process and so forth. I mean, Democratic, too, but the presidential primary process starting very, very early. And even though the war's popularity, you know, has gotten quite low, Bush's popularity is quite low, among Republicans, self-identified Republicans, the sort of people who are going to vote in this, Bush is quite popular, the war is quite popular, the surge is quite popular. And you have the guys running for the Republican nomination have somewhat questionable conservative credentials on various issues, and so can't really afford to show any kind of disloyalty to the president and to his war strategy. Whereas, you know, if things were different, right, if Rudy Giuliani and John McCain and Mitt Romney weren't the leading contenders, I think you might see someone who was an unimpeachable fiscal and social conservative trying to distance himself maybe a little bit from the war. But you don't have that happening, so this is very stark partisan split, which makes Democrats who are in districts that Bush won, you know, very nervous about what kind of actions they can take.
Yeah, and also, you know, tell me if I'm wrong, but even what Democrats are talking about now, with the exception of the Out of Iraq Now coalition, I mean, they're basically saying if the Iraqis don't meet these benchmarks, if they don't behave with the extraordinary precision of the U.S. Congress, you know, we're going to start getting out by, you know, maybe March of 2008. And it seemed, you know, it seemed to me that the surge was designed to buy Bush. First of all, it was designed to try to succeed. I should absolutely say that. But politically, it was designed to give Bush a chance to succeed in 2007. And he rolls it out in January and essentially has, it seems to me, the implicit understanding that, okay, you've got this year to make this thing work. And, you know, without a sign of progress or if things, God forbid, get worse, you know, in 2008, he's going to have very little political ground to stand on.
Right.
So it doesn't seem like to me that the Democrats are actually pushing him to do much of anything different than he probably plans to do anyway.
Well, right. I mean, the flip side of all this is that obviously while there are committed anti-war activists who want the Democrats to end the war as quickly as possible, and then there are nervous conservative Democrats, there are also cynical Democrats who, in fact, I think would like the war to continue so that they can continue to use the war and its unpopularity as an electoral issue in 2008 rather than needing to have a Democratic plan which have downsides, you know, become an issue.
Now, I will say that is kind of an explosive charge for you to say. I'm not holding you to it, but I mean, there have been some conservatives or Republicans who have said, you know, Democrats want this thing to go on. And it's one of these things where you can't, in the national interest, want this to go badly. I mean, you just can't. But you're not suggesting that some Democrats actually do, are you?
I don't think I'm saying that Democrats want the war to go badly. I'm saying that some Democrats who believe the war is going badly, or I don't even want to say it that way, that there are some Democrats for whom, you know, an important priority is just that whatever happens in Iraq clearly be the Republican Party and George W. Bush's responsibility.
Yeah.
And they don't want the Democrats to have to take responsibility for the conduct of the war unless the Democrats are actually in control of the executive branch and can actually, you know, do everything and think that politically it would be an error for a congressional party to wind up putting itself in the position of being held accountable for events abroad. You know, I think that's, you know, particularly just a sentiment among the people whose job it is to be cynical, is that, you know, they have a cynical attitude toward this. You know, just as Republicans, obviously, on some level, are goading the Democratic left on to sort of impose more and more far-reaching measures because, you know, Republican members would rather discuss John Murtha's alleged, you know, bleed them dry strategy than they would the war itself.
Yeah.
Right?
No, I think that's okay. That's reasonable. That's reasonable. And, you know, before we wrap up, the last thing I'll say is about the dynamics of the war, which you mentioned before, but I didn't respond to, the dynamics of the war inside the Republican race. And what's interesting, it seems to me, is you're right. They're all in favor of the surge. And we're talking about the major candidates. They're all in favor of the surge. They're all in favor of the war. They're all in favor of what the president is doing. But it's some more than others. And clearly the person who's identified most with the surge is John McCain. And there is a dynamic going on inside the race where the other candidates, and they've not the candidates themselves, but people in their camps, have said this to me. They said, you know, look, we're all in favor of this surge, but McCain owns the surge. Uh-huh. And what that message is look, if this goes badly, you know, we're all going to get some blame, but he's going to get more. And we'll be doing better, you know, because he'll get more of the blame.
So their view is that they are backing the surge sort of out of respect for Bush.
Yeah.
He should get his chance.
But there is...
But then it's not their idea.
That's right. But there is the potential for finger-pointing within the Republican field about the war, which is something we have not seen now. But if it does go worse, if the surge doesn't work and if there's no measurable progress in some period of time, certainly by the end of the year... there is going to be, I think, there are going to be cracks in this field of Republicans.
Right, because that, it seems to me, is what it would take to get the bold Democratic action that, you know, people on the left are hoping for. You know, what would make congressional Democrats more enthusiastic about really trying to put the screws on would be if the Republicans were shooting at each other.
Yeah.
You know, because everyone, people like to hear this story about how the other party is in disarray.
Right. that's a perennial favorite of mine, as a matter of fact.
Sure. No, exactly. You know, and I mean, especially because, in fact, there's always some level of disarray and disagreement in the House of Representatives in particular, where it's hundreds and hundreds of people. And so there's a lot of just sort of effort to kind of toss that label back and forth.
Right.
And, you know, if you see the Republican primary get a little more contentious, then I think Democrats will start going further.
All right. I think that does it for our slate of topics today. Valerie Plame, U.S. attorneys, Alberto Gonzalez, anti-war demonstrations, and the politics of the war on this war anniversary. So, listen, I enjoyed it. And
yeah, me too.
I think the next thing we do is we, together, press this button to end this particular dialogue. So we go one.